Moncrief on News Talk.
Jonathan De Burka Butler is here once again to bring us some stories from other parts of the world.
Sean, how are you getting on?
Jonathan, right. Peru, we're going to go to first. This is a grim one. This is a story involving enforced sterilization.
Yeah, so this is enforced sterilization. So there was a program that they had. Now, we've spoken about this guy a few times, right? Alberto Fujimori over the years. Former president, and during his, now he's most famous for getting rid of Shining Path, which was a left-wing communist, Marxist, whatever you want to call it, organization, right? And that was probably in the early 1990s, 1992, I think they ended that, right? So he kind of did well in that aspect, but in other aspects, he wasn't so great, right? Mm. And during his tenure, Peru had a national reproductive health and family planning program, which was basically to take indigenous people, poor people, or people that he just generally didn't like, and sterilize them, right? So over the course of about 4 years, between 1996 and 2000, over 300,000 women were sterilized, okay, in the country. 29,000 men, apparently, were involved as well. So what we're looking at here is a case that's been going for a very long time. I think it was actually opened in 2012. And now the highest human rights court in Latin America, called the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, has made a decision and has found against Peru in the case of one individual. Okay.
Is that,
that's fair enough?
That's our test case.
So the woman in this case is a woman called Celia Ramos. Okay. She was 34 in 1997. And in July, 3rd of July specifically, 1997, she went to a local clinic because there was something wrong with her. Now, at this stage, she had had three children. She was a mother of three girls, I think they were. And she went along, and I don't know exactly what was wrong with her, but anyway, what they decided to do was, in the clinic, they decided to advise her to get a tubal ligation, where the fallopian tubes are tied, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's one method of sterilization, obviously. Now, they did that procedure. They persuaded her to go through with it. However, she had a reaction to it, okay, and she died 19 days later. Now, what the court has found is they found that Peru, they condemned Peru, and they said that they were responsible for putting her through sterilization, quote, under coercion. They also said that they didn't have the correct facilities, they were, did not have the necessary equipment or medications to deal with emergencies, and in the broader scheme of thing, they basically said they were responsible for the violation of her right to life, her right to health, her personal integrity, her family, access to information, and equality before the law. And they have said to Peru, you owe this family $340,000. Okay?
Okay.
Now, inevitably, your next question is going to be, can this be enforced?
Yeah.
Yes, it can. People who are signed up to this, or the countries that are signed up to this court, are, you know, tethered to it, essentially. So they have to do what it says. So is, as you mentioned, this is a test case.
Yeah.
Does this mean the floodgates are going to open?
Yeah.
Potentially. Yes. I can't see how it won't, to be honest with you, unless, of course, the government comes up with some sort of a settlement.
Yeah. But if you're talking about 314,000 women, 24,000 men, that's, and they all get 350 grand each, or perhaps even more. That's, God knows how much money that is.
Yeah.
Has there been any comment from Fujimori or anyone who was in power at the time?
Well, so Alberto Fujimori died there recently.
He was around
for a long time. However, the timing of this is really, really interesting, right? Because as you know, one of his sons and his daughter, Keiko Fujimori, is very involved in politics still, right? Now, Keiko is actually running for election, I think for the fourth or fifth time next month. So the timing of this is of this decision is very interesting, just in terms of, okay, remember, you know, where she's coming from, if you know what I mean, and who her father was. Now, he spent a good few years in prison, and he was always a controversial figure right up until the day he died. Keiko is just as controversial. So I don't think this will do her any favours in the run-in. So it's going to have a huge impact on society in so many different ways, this decision.
Yeah, because I suppose in the first instance, are they going to pay that compensation? If they do pay the compensation, that's an admission of liability. Right. The US we're going to go to next, and specifically the state of Georgia. Mm. I suppose first describe what this prank was.
Yeah, so this is a very unfortunate story involving high school students and a teacher by the name of Jason Hughes. He was 40 years of age. The prank, I assume it was done during their midterm break or something like that. The prank wars, it's kind of a traditional thing that they do. And what happened in this instance was, I think it was just last week, a group of teenagers, five teenagers, they went to this teacher's school or to his house, and they threw toilet paper all over the house. Now, he was kind of ready for them. All right. Apparently he knew what was going on. And according to his wife, you know, he wasn't angry. He just wanted to catch them. OK, and I suppose he bought into it a little bit in many ways. Now, unfortunately, when he ran out onto the road to try and catch them, he slipped and he went under one of the cars and subsequently died when he was brought to hospital. Now, the car that was involved was being driven by an 18-year-old called Jaden Ryan Wallace. He was driving the pickup, and he's accused now of running over the teacher as he attempted to drive away. So he has now been charged with homicide by vehicle in the first degree, which is could give him 15 years in prison. There's other charges against him as well, including reckless driving, criminal trespass and littering. And the other four teenagers are being charged with misdemeanors around trespass and littering. So they're in big trouble. But what's interesting about this and what stood out to me is that the man's wife, a woman by the name Laura, who's also a teacher in the local high school, this is the North Hall High School in Gainesville in Georgia, as you said, she's come out and she's asked for the charges to be dropped. She's basically said, look, this was a tragic accident, but she wants to prevent a separate tragedy from occurring and ruining the lives of these students, which I think is very extraordinary.
But it probably doesn't carry any legal weight. They won't drop the charges because his wife said so.
No, not at all. And you know the way they are in the United States. They like throwing people in the clink and making examples of people. Whether it will sway, when the thing goes to trial, it will sway the judge, who will maybe sentence him to 15 years, but, you know, not send him to actual prison.
Yes.
It might have some influence, but it's a very interesting development.
Had there been, you know, this thing is a tradition, but had there been any concern about these pranks in the past in that area?
Yeah.
That might go a bit too far.
Yeah, the school actually came out with a statement before this prank season started and said, look, there's been similar stunts and they've escalated too far in previous years, so we need to put a stop to it. So they had been warned, in fairness, but nobody could have foreseen this, I don't think.
Yeah. Right, Hungary we're going to go to next, where the bit of tension between Hungary and Ukraine involving, it sounds like a James Bond film, cash and gold bars.
Yeah, so these are two vans that were stopped carrying over $80 million in cash and 9 kilograms worth of gold bars, which is equivalent at the moment to 1.3 million euros, apparently.
Okay.
So these were two vans with that cash, those gold bars, and 7 Ukrainian citizens inside. Now, what these citizens were doing was they were going from a bank in Austria to a bank in Ukraine, and they were simply transporting this stuff, right?
Okay.
However, the Hungarian authorities, when they detained the vehicles, arrested the occupants, and they took a video of the whole thing, and then they released it online and put dramatic music around it. Okay, and what they were trying to infer was the idea that these people were transporting cash and gold to keep the war going, this war against Russia as they see it.
Right.
Okay. Now, I'm not saying all Hungarians see it that way.
Yeah.
I'm saying
but
the current authorities
would see it that
exactly.
way. Exactly. Yes.
Orban and the head of Fidesz and that kind of thing. Now, it should be said that, you know, there are aspects of politics in, or politicians in Hungary and politicians in Ukraine who've always had problems with each other, right?
Yes.
There is a section of Ukraine that has about 150,000 Hungarians living in it right on the border there, and the Hungarians would like to have it back, even though it's, you know, 80 years ago that it was given to the USSR, as it was at the time. So there's a bit of animosity there between them anyway that predates the Russian invasion. But Orban is very outspoken about his support for Putin. And of course, he thinks the EU is trying to take away all of Hungary's autonomy and every country's autonomy and drag them into this war against Russia. But again, the timing of this is very, very interesting because, as you probably know, next month, elections, general elections on April the 12th in Hungary, and he is behind.
Yeah.
And he's behind quite significantly. He's about 10 points behind the leading candidate at the moment, a man called by the name of Peter Magyar, which, of course, Magyar is the name of Hungary.
It's, yes.
That's, it's Magyar yeah. is Hungarian and Hungarian. Yeah. He's in trouble. And so Fidesz and Orban are pinning an awful lot of their campaign around anti-Ukrainian sentiment and anti-EU sentiment. And so the timing of it is again, very yeah. interesting.
And the people who were transporting the gold and the money and the gold and the money itself, was it being smuggled? You know, I assume there's some sort of documentation that has to go along with this kind of thing.
Absolutely not. The cargo was registered under international transport rules. EU customs procedures knew about it. And more to the point, it happened every week, uh-huh. right? So they've been transporting this stuff overland because they've had to. Okay, because they
because there's a no-fly zone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yeah.
So that's what they've been doing. So, you know, presumably the Hungarian authorities knew all about this. So this was, dare I say it,
a stunt, perhaps.
Yeah, it was staged. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. And the Ukrainians are obviously very annoyed about it. And I don't know if these seven people have been released yet, in fact. They certainly weren't at the time that I saw this story. So I don't know what's going on or how it's going to play out in the end.
Yeah. Has it been named who they were, these seven Ukrainians?
They were bank officials.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. They didn't actually work for the Ukrainian state, so to say.
No, it was for, I think, the largest bank in, I can't remember what it's called, but it's the largest bank in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it's state-owned or what,
yeah.
but they were bank officials. Yeah. That was it, really.
And this would cast a bit of doubt on whether they can keep doing this if these vans are going to be stopped.
It's a good point. Yeah,
yeah.
Good point. Yeah.
Well, I suppose they could drive in through Poland. Take another route, but it's probably a bit longer, especially if you're driving overland with that amount of money in the back of your van. Right. India, we're going to go to next. Now, is this like these were. Somebody was citing legal precedent that didn't exist,
yeah,
was it?
That's essentially it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a. It all started, more or less started in August of last year. In a town called Vijayawada, which is in Andhra Pradesh, down in the south of the country, okay? And there's a property dispute going on. This is in a fairly low-level court, and it involves a junior judge, okay? And the court had previously assigned an official to survey property and file a report. So it was a property dispute. I don't know if I said that. Mm. And the defendants in this case objected to it. Now, I'm not sure why they objected to it, okay, or whether it was the report itself or the contents of the report, but they objected to it, right? And the judge dismissed their objection. And in explaining her objection, or sorry, her dismissal, she cited four past legal judgments. So that was grand and everybody went away. But the defence had a closer look at those judgments and discovered that they actually didn't exist. She later admitted that she had generated these judgments or that they'd been thrown up by AI.
Yes.
And in fact, as you said, they didn't exist at all. And so it meant that she had based her decision on these cases that didn't exist. So naturally enough, the defence went back and they appealed, right? So they went to the state's high court, and the high court acknowledged the citations were fake, but said that the judge had acted in good faith, and they upheld the decision, stating that incorrect or non-existent citations alone were not grounds to overturn a ruling if the legal reasoning was otherwise sound.
Okay.
So the defense said, no, can't go with this at all.
Yeah.
So they took it up to the next level and they went to the Supreme Court. Now, remarkably, because these things usually take years in India, but the Supreme Court came back with a decision and it said the use of AI while making judgments was not simply an error in decision making, but an act of misconduct, which is damn right.
Yeah.
She's basing her ideas on these precedents that didn't exist. So basically, they've stayed the decision of the state high court. They haven't overturned the ruling yet because they're more concerned at this moment in time with the status of this junior judge.
Yes.
And what she's done.
Yeah.
So she could be in trouble, but it remains to be seen at this point.
Okay, so they've been a bit slow about it because you would have thought if a judge was citing a fake AI documents as precedent, that would be grounds for, you know, at least suspension immediately.
Yes, I haven't heard if she has been suspended or dismissed or what's happening, but they're going to look further into that as it happens. But it's not the first time it's happened. We're hearing cases like in the United States, in the UK as well, where not necessarily judgments, but certainly, you know, people are coming up with precedents and this and examples and they don't exist.
Yeah. What's the point of going to law school for however many years? One would have thought you have to look it up on AI. Right. Finally, Iceland we're going to go to, and they're reviving their interest in joining the EU.
Yeah, I thought we'd end on a bit of a positive note, but it's interesting to see that they're doing it now. And it probably has nothing to do with the threats to Greenland or Trump.
Yeah.
Because they did have a look at joining before, when they were in trouble before financially. You might remember Iceland and Ireland had similar trajectories around their story at that time. So that was back in 2009. But they froze the talks in 2013 because there was a dispute over fishing, which I'm sure people here could sympathise with. And then they formally withdrew the application in 2015. But now the Prime Minister there has decided to hold a referendum on August the 29th to decide whether to relaunch the stalled talks to join the European Union. So that'll be interesting. Now, opinion polls are fairly clear, right? In the sense that the vast majority of people in Iceland will vote yes to have these talks reinitiated.
Okay.
However, as to whether they want to join the European Union or not is not as clear cut. It's kind of 50-50 at the moment.
Okay.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
But we'll see, because, you know, what will Iceland want, and what will the EU want from Iceland, I think, more importantly, and how can it benefit both of them? And I think it's going to be really interesting to see, because Iceland has no standing army, but I mean, there's no doubt that if the EU says to Iceland, okay, you can join, but we need a bit of your, you know, not wasteland, but a bit of your countryside to throw in a few, you know, missiles and that kind of base.
That might
and that
be a
kind of
NATO kind of decision rather than a European Union.
Yeah.
I don't think that's within their remit at the moment.
You never, it might change in the meantime, but I wonder, will it put pressure on us? But anyway, that's just another story altogether.
Well, I remember, but I imagine that, as you said, fishing might be a huge issue with this.
Definitely.
Huge issue with that. Right, so what should we look out for over the next week or so?
Yeah, so March 11th, so that's tomorrow, I think, events commemorating 15 years since the huge earthquake in Japan, which triggered the Fukushima nuclear disaster. So there'll be events around that. 15 years, I can't believe it. And then Sunday, local elections in France. So speaking of Orban losing next year, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the right in those local elections in France. There's a presidential election coming. Is it later this year or early next year in France? Not sure. So interesting to watch that. And then on Sunday, the Oscars, of course.
Yes, of course. Jonathan, thanks a million. As ever, Jonathan DeBoker Butler there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.